Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each and every week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. What kind of architect do you want to be? This is episode 317, Growing Your Architecture Firm Through Respect, Teaching, and Learning, with Turan Duda and Jeffrey Payne of Duda Payne Architects. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love. And our friends at RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more for free at RCAT.com. Turan Duda and Jeffrey Payne, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Turan Duda, FAIA, is founding principal at Duda Payne Architects, based in Durham, North Carolina. Turan is a passionate believer in ideas as catalyst for great design. His conceptual focus and dynamic design approach have led the creation of innovative projects for a wide spectrum of building types, scales, and purposes. He is also an advocate for placemaking in cities such as Austin, Texas, Atlanta, Georgia, Washington, D.C., Raleigh, North Carolina, and Monterrey, Mexico. Turan is reshaping building form to meet the demands of today's communities, foster a sustainable world, and inspire the future. Turan is a frequent speaker on topics such as design methodology and the role of public space within private development. In 2012, he was elevated to the AIA's College of Fellows for his approach to architectural design. Congratulations to you for the FIAA. Jeffrey Payne, FAIA, is a founding principal of Duda Payne Architects and sees the architectural process as an opportunity to expand the power and function of design. Jeff leads the technical execution of every Duda Payne project. Jeff is a frequent speaker at graduate programs in architecture, real estate development, and business and professional forums. He recently completed a four-week research project on the history, implications, and influences of public spaces in architecture at the American Academy in Rome. So, Turan and Jeff, thank you for being here. I shared a little bit about you and what you do at Duda Payne. Before we get started into our conversation, I would love to dive a little bit deeper. I'd love to have you share your story, your journey from where you discovered your passion for architecture and where you find yourself today. We'd love to hear your origin stories. Let's start with Turan.
Thank you for talking to us this morning. You know, I think I probably have a story that's similar to many architects out there. My family actually were a family of immigrants. We traveled all over Europe before the age of 7 and 8. came to the U.S., settled in North Carolina, and of course when I finished high school, my father said, "What would you like to be when you grow up?" And I said, "I want to be an artist." And he quickly picked up the newspaper, looked at the ads, and said, "I don't see any advertising for artists. You better find a real profession where you can make money and I don't have to support you the rest of your life." So my passion was for art, and the challenge was finding a profession where I could use my artistic skills in a way to create a living. And architecture became that passion for me, because I realized that the challenges of architecture are not just making beautiful things, but also impacting people's lives. And so it's a wonderful, wonderful challenge. I went on from NC State College of Design, undergraduate school, to Yale for 3 years to get my master's. And it's there that I met Cesar Pelli. He was the dean of the architecture school. He hired me right after I got out of graduate school and said, "I'd like you to come work for me." The office was only 6 people at the time. Of course, it grew to be 120. But I have to say, one of the most important words of advice I can give a young architect, or even a graduating architect, is how important it is to have a great architect as a mentor. Mentorship is essential. Teaching and learning the craft of what we do as architects is really, really important. After spending 17 years with Cesar and the New Haven office, I think both Jeff and I felt we were ready to fly. We had grown our wings and we were ready to create our own firm, have our own voices out there, and to see what we could do as a two architects who are beginning an office. So it's a wonderful journey to be able to have learned what we have learned from a great teacher, a great mentor. And you don't really sometimes really even know how much you've learned until you have left the nest.
Yeah.
That's when you realize just how much you have built into your memory of design skills and the muscles that you have in your imagination. So it's something that I think is essential. And oftentimes when I was teaching for 10 years at Yale, I used to tell the students, choose wisely, because the first office that you work for, the first architect you work for, can really set your expectation of what architecture should be and can be. And you want someone who's going to inspire you at the highest level and show you how it can be done. Because this is such a challenging profession we have with all of its complexities.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Taran. Jeff, would you like to share your origin story?
Yes. I started being interested in art and architecture as a young boy in sixth grade. By then, I knew I wanted to be an architect. I think I was partially influenced by a great uncle who was a very noted American architect, Ralph Walker. My dad used to take me to visit him at his home, and I think I was enthralled with his larger-than-life persona. I also had an older brother who's an artist and a musician, and so I was very intrigued with this duality of the architectural profession. There's the artistic side, and then there's the business side. And there has to be this this balance between the two. I think that speaks to why Taran and I have been successful in many ways, because as the managing principal, and he as the design principal, it's worked out well for us in pairing our skill sets. We're still both in every design review. We challenge each other's thinking. There's a lot of power in that. Thinking back to when we first met, we met in 1982, working for Cesar Pelli, as Taran had mentioned. Prior to that, I worked for Kevin Roach, John Dinkaloo and Associates. Kevin Roach is another gold medalist. And just to repeat what Taran said, having a mentor or mentors like that is really critical, and we've been blessed by having them in our lives. So when we met in 82, Teron had been there for a couple of years. He, as he said, he was the sixth employee. I think I was the 34th employee. And people would ask us, friends would ask us over that duration of time of 15 or 17 years, when are you going to leave and start your own practice or do something else? And we always felt like we were learning something and we were progressing our careers, but also progressing our abilities as architects and as people that had to really meet the expectations of our clients. You know, it's easy to forget sometimes that this is a service profession. So balancing those needs and doing great architecture is something we learned. It took a long time for us to learn it. Maybe we're slow learners, but we didn't start our practice until we were both about 45. And, you know, they talk about the 10,000 hour rule. And we're, I think, really products of that thinking. We worked a long time with Caesar and a long time beside each other. And when we started our practice in 97, it was really the strength of our partnership, our relationship, that led us to want to start our own firm. I don't think, I think Teron would probably agree, but I know I never had this great burning desire to have my own office and practice architecture as a startup company. So it didn't come out of any, us starting did not come out of any frustration with whom we worked for. We still, you know, Caesar was a great mentor and a great employer, and we got to work on projects all over the world, and it was very enticing, and we were well compensated, and people liked to work on our teams within the office. But it was really just this thought that Teron and I had grown and matured and sort of were ready to matriculate out of working for Caesar. And he always sort of felt that way, that his office was more of a training ground than a lifelong commitment for people. So he had an immediate strong reaction when we gave him the news. But since then, from that first moment, he was very supportive of us, came to visit us more than once, really thought of us as maybe the next generation. Whereas he and Kevin Roach both came out of Eric Saarinen's firm. I think Caesar saw that we were the progression of his way of thinking about both balancing, you know, client expectations, showing them multiple ways of solving a problem, engaging them in the process with respect and care, but also definitely pushing a design agenda, definitely wanting to think about, you know, what is the next great opportunity for building design. So it's been a great ride.
You both put an emphasis on the importance of mentorship, that Caesar Pelli was clearly a strong mentor to you. Did he bring you in with that idea that I would be your mentor, or was that just sort of a result of the relationship that you had when you joined them as employees?
I think he was actually continuing a tradition. And the tradition that he came from, I remember as a student, I asked him, who was your greatest influence? And he said, Saarinen. And I said, but your work doesn't look anything like Saarinen. And he said, that's exactly the point. It's not the product, it's the process. Yeah. The process of exploring architecture. That's really what he was referring to. And that process is one that he continued in his firm, in that Caesar would draw everyone to the table and have a conversation. Very Socratic in that process, asking great questions, quizzing you. Caesar would ask you the questions your client is going to ask you. So if you think about it, he's training you. Yeah. Because Caesar was the toughest client we ever had. His logic, his rigor was incredibly powerful. And you had to pass mustard with him before you could ever step in front of a client. Well, you can't ask for a better training than when you finally are off on your own, to be able to stand up in front of very difficult, very tough-minded clients and be able to speak to them. One of the things that I should say, though, is that in observing him present and seeing how he went about it, one of my rules, I think, is that as I teach my next generation of people who are here, is learn another language. And first, they're quizzical about what I mean when I say that. Well, the language that we speak is the language of architects. Well, you're presenting to lawyers, you're presenting to doctors, you're presenting to bankers. They speak a different language. And if you can figure out what that language is and make your presentations, make your work about them and about their language of world of ideas, you get much more success than if we have the artists speak that we're so accustomed to speaking with each other. It's probably one of the best lessons that I learned is if you ever listen to Caesar present architecture, he would speak about it experientially. He would speak about it inspirationally. It was rarely about just the problem solving. The problem solving was there, but at the end of the day, what inspires people is the fact that we have a common experience of how we experience architecture.
Was Caesar open with the business end of his firm? Did he sort of teach you how he ran his firm to be as successful as it was?
Well, Caesar had a partner, Fred Clark. The firm is now called Pelly Clark Pelly. Fred was very much my mentor when it came to running the business side of things, seeking out opportunities, doing business development, responding to requests for proposals, putting teams of consultants together, and negotiating contracts and setting up schedules of delivery of the work, and then really maintaining that relationship, that, if you will, business relationship with the client or clients, and making certain that, again, we were providing great design, but that it was done with respect and care. And to Tehran's point, care towards the things that they were concerned about. When a client is hiring you to spend $100 or $200 or $300 million, that's a great amount of trust they're putting in you. And they want to make certain that even though you might have a great reputation, that on their project, that you're going to take the care, that you're going to design things that are within their budget, that you're going to produce drawings that are good drawings and they're released on schedule, and that you're going to work with the contractor or the construction manager to make certain that the building is built on time, on budget, and there aren't a lot of claims or anything like that. So Caesar was, very much into the art of the profession, whereas Fred was assisting in the business side of the equation.
Do you feel, and you have this similar relationship with Tehran, do you feel that that was one of the keys to their success? Do you think Caesar could have become Caesar Pelly, quote unquote, if he didn't have Mr. Clark as his partner?
Well, let me answer the question relative to us.
Yeah, okay.
Because we could have gone off on our own and started a practice. The last couple of projects Tehran and I were working together on, working for Pelly, he was the design team leader and I was the project manager, and we would travel to these projects and we would have a great opportunity to talk not just about architecture or the business of architecture, but what made us tick, what was important to us, what we wanted, what we were thinking for the rest of our careers, because that mid-40s is a time, I think, where you're thinking, okay, is this where I'm going to spend the rest of my career?
Right.
So we're smart enough to realize that this is a team sport, that there isn't one person that does everything well. So we teamed up. And, as I said, we both consider ourselves designers. I'm in all the design reviews with the teams here. But I definitely defer to Tehran when it comes to the final decision about something on the design side. I defer to him, and likewise, he defers to me on a tough business decision. But there's this, left brain, right brain, and it's not just something that works for us. I think it gives clients, consultants, contractors, and even our employees a sense of comfort because they realize, Tehran is going to definitely err on the side of, what's the very best design solution for this, even if it takes longer or we have to, talk the client into spending more money, and where I'm going to think about it slightly differently. And in the middle there is some, it's that creative tension that I mentioned relative to the two sides of this business. You can be a very successful architect in terms of designing great buildings and still go out of business. You can be a very successful businessman architect and produce really bad buildings that aren't really architecture. So I think we rely on each other. And as I said earlier, the strength of our relationship, the trust that we have in each other, people see that, and we're never competing with one another. People that interact with us, whether it be an employee or a client, they see that and they're comforted because they realize, wow, these two guys see that creative tension. They're debating it together in front of me, and they want to come up with the best solution for me and my project.
It's funny, in the beginning, we used to have the saying that we would tell people, some people were surprised that we paired up, that we became partners. And we used to have the saying that if you're going to start a band, you would not want to start with two drummers.
That's true.
That you really want to find complementary skill sets because this profession that we're in is challenging enough as it is. And the last thing you would want is two very strong minded designers competing with each other in the same firm. It's a recipe for disaster, and I've seen it happen in many offices.
Yeah.
So I think being very thoughtful, very purposeful in how we structured this firm was really important to us. We were also smart enough to realize in the very beginning, I remember telling Jeff, the most important thing we have to build in the beginning is our reputation. Because that reputation will bring us more work, it will bring us more clients. And we're really proud of the fact that we spoil our clients. our clients come back to us. There's about 70% of our work are repeat clients because they really enjoyed the working process with us. If you talk to me long enough, you'll hear me say the word process many, many times because the process is such an essential part of what we do. I like to believe that we are incredibly transparent with our process, and we invite our clients into that process, and they're part of that making of architecture with us. Which, if you think about it, most people have no clue what we do. Most people have no idea what an architect actually does. They think they either are dreaming on top of a mountain with a sketchbook, or they think that we're pulling drawings out of a drawer and running blueprints. It's a very arcane expectation and perception of what architects do. They have no idea what the complexities are that we deal with. So if we can bring our clients into that world, show them and demonstrate visually through all of our devices the decision-making process, now all of a sudden they're co-authoring the work with us, and they're feeling as though they are involved, they are part of the solution. My favorite element at the very end of a project is when I'm not there to present or explain the project, but my client can. They can tell you why the building is the way it is, as opposed to simply saying this is because that's what the architect wanted. So those are really important factors for us, that notion of a buy-in, the notion of co-authorship, and you know, I've had friends, architects, who have said to me, well, aren't you afraid to let them see everything? You know, isn't that a scary thing to you? Because they might pick the wrong thing. And I said, well, it's not a simple multiple choice test. There's a process here in which we're explaining the pros and cons of every decision and choice that they might make. And that's very edifying and very satisfying for our clients. I think they feel as though we're being honest with them. They feel as though they have a voice, and it's only going to make the project that much better.
So you launched the firm in 1997, 23 years ago. I've looked at your work. I've seen your work. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. You have some very high profile clients, some very large projects. What is the marketing process to gain projects like that? What do you do in order to go through the process of being on the list for projects such as that?
You know, I teach a class over at NC State once a semester in the pro practice class about marketing, public relations, and business development. And I talk about the distinctions of those three tasks. And, you know, this was on-the-job training for us when we first started our firm. But the business development end of it, starting relationships with people, building those relationships, as Teron said, building our reputation through those relationships. And early on, a lot of our work, honestly, came from one client saying to another client, you need to meet these two guys and engage them, and we're very happy. As you get larger, you need to get into more public relations and marketing. We have a very strategic approach to that. I lead that effort, and it's purposeful. It's looking at different markets, commercial office and corporate headquarters versus smaller academic or institutional projects. You chase them in very different ways, we want to do both. One of the things that Duran and I love about our current portfolio is the diversity of the work. And that's both interesting from a design perspective, working on buildings that are to us meaningful buildings, but also as a business strategy, you know, if the stock market takes a nosedive, we still have academic institutional projects to work on and things like that. We also like the fact that we're not just in one locale or one region, but we have a pretty broad reach now. But, you know, it has been 23 years, and it does take time to build that reputation. I think we're purposeful about it. I think it only gets more difficult. I have this joke when I meet people at cocktail parties. I say the problem with architecture is the building gets built in that, you know, you're constantly needing to find new clients and new opportunities, and there aren't a lot of people out there other than maybe commercial developers that are constantly building new buildings. So you have to cast a wide net and, you know, repeatedly stay in touch with people. In our foreword for our book, Individual to Collective, Cesar Pelli wrote that he felt there was still a place for a smaller design-focused firm like ours in this new world of mega firms, where the large firms are gobbling up the small firms for both portfolio, talent, and geographical positioning as well. So we're often competing against very large firms with multiple offices with hundreds, if not thousands, of people working for them. And we are what we would call a generalist firm. We don't specialize in any one project typology. We like doing more and more student services buildings, student-focused buildings like student unions. We just finished our Emory Student Union, and 5 years ago, the NC State Student Union. So we feel like there is still a place for a firm like ours that can do the work in the scale that Tehran and I were taught to do working for a firm like Pelley. Very large projects. Not all of our projects are large, but we now have the capability of delivering very large projects. And that has really allowed us to broaden our scope and opportunities. But we are more often than not competing against very large firms that will bring in a, what they call a thought leader from a particular studio. And that person will talk about, you know, their knowledge when it comes to a certain building type. And we don't want a firm that practices in this this cupboard-like approach where it's all studios and there's thought leaders and experts. We feel like, you know, we're pretty quick reads, pretty fast learners. And when we do need to know more about a more complicated building type, we're not afraid to team with people that know more than we do about a building type. So a lot of our practice in the past 20 years has been teaming up with other firms when it made sense for the client. And I think our clients appreciate the flexibility that from the very beginning we show in how we would propose to deliver a project.
How large is your firm?
We're in the low 60s right now, about 60 employees.
And I still consider ourselves a small firm. You know, I think when people use that phrase, a small firm, in many ways it's a mindset more than it is scale, the number of people. Because I think that the bureaucracy that comes with becoming a larger and larger firm in some ways is the thing that becomes a stumbling block. We love that the scale that we're at. We love the fact that we can still give the kind of personalized attention to every project that we're doing. So, and that goes a long way. I think that clients notice that, they see that. Coming back to something Jess said, you know, when we first started our firm, one of our former clients asked the question, so what kind of architect do you want to be? And we're both kind of stunned and puzzled at the question. What do you mean by that? Well, do you want to be a medical specialist? Do you want to be a commercial architect? Do you want to be an academic architect? What do you want to be? And frankly, we had never thought of it that way. We thought an architect is an architect. An architect has the tools, has the wherewithal, has the analytical skills to tackle a project of any scale and of any type. In some ways, I would say that would be my advice to a small firm, is to continue to absolutely learn and absorb as much information that you can about every building type. Because we're living in a world where the diversity of the work is overlapping, that the different typologies of architecture are overlapping. And if you have the critical analytical skills, you can figure out any building type. Sometimes I think expertise is overrated, because I think that looking at things in a fresh way, especially when a client comes to you and says, I'm thinking of doing something new and something different. I'm thinking of you designing a new paradigm for me of how we're going to work. Our NCR project in Atlanta recently finished. Headquarters, a million square foot headquarters for a big corporation. The day we went in for the interview, the head of facility said, this project for us is a matter of survival. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we have to be able to attract the best and brightest people out there to come work for us. We can't do that where we're currently located out in the suburbs. We want to be in an urban location near an academic center like Georgia Tech, we want to be in a place where we can draw those people. Well, that type of project for us, we already had the kind of information we needed to create the environment for attracting those young people, because we had done a student center. And if you think about it, the kids coming out of colleges and universities who experience a student center, create those environments, are expecting that when they go to the real world and they're working for corporate America. So here's a cross-pollination of information that we get from an academic client translated to a corporate client. And this is where I think being nimble, being flexible, understanding, and being able to make these kinds of connections are really critical for the survival of architects going forward. I think that ability to be quick on your feet, because the world around us is changing very, very quickly, and expectations are changing quickly about how we work, how we play, how we commune with each other. And it's changing architecture. It's changed our architecture dramatically in the last 5 to 10 years.
We will return to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors, FreshBooks and ARCAT. 192 hours. In case you're wondering, 192 hours works out to 2 business days per month. Why the math? Well, if you're an architect and you're using FreshBooks cloud accounting software, that's the amount of admin time you can save every year. How? FreshBooks is so fast and easy to use that it changes the way you deal with your paperwork. FreshBooks is the simplest way to be more productive, more organized, and most importantly, will get you paid faster. You can create and send really professional-looking invoices in under 30 seconds. When you email a client an invoice, FreshBooks can show you whether they've seen it, which puts an end to those guessing games. If waiting for a client check in the mail is slowing down your cash flow, with literally 2 clicks, you can set yourself up to receive payments online. Oh, and your clients will love paying by credit card straight from their invoice. FreshBooks helps you avoid having that awkward talk with your clients about past due payments. FreshBooks automatically sends late payment email reminders, so you can spend less time chasing payments and more time working your magic on the drafting board or on the computer. If you have any questions whatsoever, FreshBooks' award-winning customer service is amazingly helpful, super friendly, and zero attitude. Plus, a real live person usually answers the phone in 3 rings or less. To claim your month-long unrestricted free trial, go to entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. Have you been to ARCAT.com recently? It's the number one most used website for finding building product information. Their powerful search tool allows you to choose what kind of information you want, like CAD, BIM, specifications, and only get results with that data. ARCAT is also constantly fine-tuning their search engine to make sure that you keep getting the information that you asked for. And of course, it's free. It requires no registration, no login, no credit card. If you need product building information and you haven't used ARCAT recently, or maybe you've never tried ARCAT, head over there right now to ARCAT.com and try it out. You'll be glad you did. That's ARCAT.com, ARCAT.com. ARCAT.com. Build better content today. FreshBooks and ARCAT. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
As a successful generalist architecture firm, is there something that you feel differentiates you from other generalist architecture firms? I think a lot of architects want to be a generalist, but they're afraid that there's nothing that sort of separates them from all the other architects, right? If all the architects are generalists and we do everything, what is it that's sort of our brand? What's our differentiation that's making us successful? Why would people choose your firm over another? Is there something specific that you see as a differentiator? Is there something that you are intentionally developing as a brand for your firm that differentiates you from other firms?
One thing I think we like to say, you know, in a way, we're all thought leaders. We've hired people. I remember when Caesar won the gold medal, and he announced to the firm he had won it, and he said, this proves something I always believed, that if you hire very talented and hardworking people around you, they would make you very successful. And our employees here, we always, I like to say Tarun and I are very good at hiring people, because we always hire attitude over aptitude, and we're looking for a consistency, not in thinking or design approach, but values. And one of the things we've heard from our clients is there's such a homogeneity in the people that are successful here. They know what our ideals are, the design agendas we want to push, what's important to Tarun and I, and what's not important. But as well, they understand that it is a service profession, that we have to listen to our clients. And again, it's not just listening, but we haven't talked so much about this, but we've mentioned it, this engaging of our clients in our design process, mm-hmm. I think is quite unique. We've developed that from the base of working with Caesar, that you don't just put a model or a rendering in front of a client and ask them, do you like this? You come to the room with three or four model options, drawing options, and you say, this is, you know, we were thinking about this with this idea and this other thing with this idea. And we go through this process, and it's sort of an inside joke for Tarun and I, because more often than not, they listen to the presentation, they've seen three or four options, and they turn to us and say, which one do you like best? And they often will assume it's the last one we showed them, and it won't be. But obviously, we're showing clients ideas, any one of which we could develop into being great architecture. So doing that, we have to have people that are you know, have good judgment, people that are thinking about what we're doing. You know, it's not just with the advent of computer technology getting more and more powerful. It's not just, you know, let's produce 25 different options, none of which have any range of value, but let's just produce ideas to produce ideas. It's really thinking about, you know, what we're producing and why. I don't like to use the word in our office to describe us as intellectual, but it is an intellectual community or culture here, where, and Tarun mentioned this earlier, in regard to talking about Caesar being our most demanding client. Our studios are open office. The pinup area is, you know, surrounded by other people working on other things. People are taught to present their ideas to us, or to develop the ideas we've talked about as the leaders of the design, and then come back to us with the development of those ideas, maybe pushing a fourth idea that we hadn't thought of. But they're really, in a way, I mean, this is why they call them juries, right? They're standing there advocating for an approach. And anyone in this office, at any time, it could be their first day working here, are encouraged to challenge not just each other's thinking, but Tarun's and my thinking, you know, and do it in a way where you say, you know, I know, Tarun, you wanted us to do this, and we've done that, but would you consider doing this? Or why are we doing that solution instead of this one? So it's a very Socratic approach, and it's an approach that challenges us all to be better, all to think about what we're doing and why. And then when we send people out to meet with clients, again, they're not just trained to meet our expectations, but they're ready to advocate in a respectful way and engage our clients in our process. I think engaging our clients is probably, if not the biggest distinction of the way we work, certainly one of the top distinctions.
Yeah. I mean, as you discuss your firm, it sounds like the process itself, the bringing clients into your process is a differentiator, as well as your culture. You talk about the relationship you have with your staff and the way your culture at your firm is built, that then resonates out beyond your firm to help make you successful. Where do you see the future of DoDotPayne going? So as your firm grows and time moves on, do you have a plan for the future of DoDotPayne and how it continues to grow beyond the two of you?
You know, the beautiful thing about being in an environment, creating a culture that's about respect, teaching, and learning. Those three things, those three elements, those three words, in my view, can pertain to anyone. Can pertain to your client relationship, to the relationship of people that work in the firm. And, you know, in a way, I think and we've been doing this now for 24 years, you hope for the first 20 years you're building a body of work, a portfolio of work that you can be really, really proud of. I think the next 20 years is going to be Jeff and I being really proud of the next group of leaders that we have in this firm and what they're going to, how they're going to push the firm forward and actually push the work forward. One of the beauties of having a culture where everyone has a voice, everyone gets to practice their voice here, and everyone over time sees their voice mature with time. And it allows us to maintain the diversity of thinking that we still have, because there are multiple voices in this firm who can continue to push the work forward. So rather than it being a Jeff and my voice that becomes the end all of design, we now have four more people who are going to assume principles, who will assume leadership here, a design voice is going forward. And I think that's a very healthy place to be. You know, when you think about architects who fostered different models, you know, Caesar used to tell us that even though Frank Lloyd Wright was an incredibly talented architect, very few people came out of the shop to become their own architect, to do anything beyond that. As compared to Saarinen, who had six or seven really well-known architects come out of his studio and to go on and create their own work in their own studios. And that's really a mindset. That is this notion that through leadership, you can create a diversity of voice as opposed to a singular voice, which is that of the mentor. It's a very different way of thinking about it. So we're excited. I'm really excited because I feel like we also have now this body of knowledge, not just body of work, body of knowledge that we can push forward with that's going to make us even more nimble and even more creative in terms of the work that we're doing.
Yeah, I think as exciting as it is to build that 20-year portfolio, I could imagine that the pride that comes with the next 20 years of sort of watching all that hard work blossom into a bigger, not necessarily a bigger, but a firm that continues to grow and evolve, and other leaders become, you know, the face, and I could imagine that becomes very, very, you know, it makes you feel good about what you've done the past 20 years. I'd like to sort of wrap things up with our one question for both of you. Let's start with Jeff. What is one thing that a small firm architect could do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, you know, our experience is one that was wrapped around this notion of 10,000 hours. And we started, you know, our practice in our middle age. I mentioned at 45. I'm not saying that's the only way to do it. I'm just thinking out loud, though, about the answer to your question. You know, when we started our practice in 97, we weren't sure what we were going to do. In answer to that question, a former client asked, what kind of architect do you want to be? But we cast a wide net and we entered a competition in Charlotte to design a project that became Gateway Village, which was 1 million square feet. So we were two guys, had just started our practice a month earlier, and we were given the opportunity to enter this competition against very large established firms. Someone took a chance at us, with us, and gave us the opportunity to compete in that realm. So immediately we had this opportunity to work within the scale and realm that we had been trained to work. One of the things I'm encouraged by in the Carolinas is the great diversity of work in firms here, whether it be residential or small commercial projects, restaurants and whatnot. There's some great design being done here in North Carolina. I'm a board member of the AI Triangle, and I'm really just impressed with the quality of design work at any scale that comes out of the Carolinas. So maybe my answer to your question would be stay flexible and do what you do well, but also, you know, try things that you'd like to do, but maybe don't think you're qualified to do, like a 1 million square foot project with two people, and see if you can't do that. Because that obviously opened up doors for us and immediately answered a question that I would think that would be on any client's mind working with a small firm that was just starting to establish itself. And that is, can this firm really do a project of that scale? So we like immediately with a resounding yes answered that question, and it led to other opportunities across the Southeast and beyond working at that scale. So I think it's great to have a business plan. I think it's great to, you know, even if you want to start younger than we did, but don't just limit yourself to doing, you know, a certain scale or a certain type of project. The flip side of that is we recently, about 8 years ago, completed a project that's a swim and racket club for Duke faculty. And it was a $2 million project. And a couple of the people here in the office asked me when I said we wanted to do that project, well, why would you want to do a project so small? And I said, we definitely want to do a project like that because we haven't done one. So there's sort of this, you know, I'm not suggesting that everybody throw caution to the wind with their careers or their livelihood, but we constantly push ourselves to do things that we maybe haven't done before. A project like that, we probably didn't make much money on it. It's won several design awards. So I would just say, do what you do well, but also push yourself to do things that maybe intuitively you wouldn't assume you could do, and see where that might lead.
Fantastic. Taran, what about you? What is one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
You know, I've told the story many times. When I graduated from graduate school at Yale, my best friend was actually a someone in the fine arts department as a painter. And he and I were both graduating, and I turned to him and I said, well, you know, congratulations, you're finishing graduate school as a painter. What kind of paintings will you be doing? And he said, I'll let you know in 20 years. And I thought that was, at first I thought that's kind of a wise-ass answer to give, but at the same time I said it's actually a pretty wise answer to give. Because in this world that we live in, you don't know where the next opportunity is going to come from. You don't, very few of us actually write a manifesto and say, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. But in the field of architecture in particular, as I said, this dynamic world that's changing, it's just a matter of who picks up the phone and calls you and says, have you done one of these? Would you like to try? That willingness to try something new, the willingness to be open and flexible and nimble, will serve you really, really well. Because I think the dead end is for an architect to say, oh, I don't do that kind of work. Yeah. We take every project as a great opportunity to try something new, regardless of what it is. I have architect friends who say to me, why do you even do developer work? That's the dark side. Those, all they care about is money. Well, if you're willing to teach, if you're willing to be respectful and to teach in a way that edifies your client, guess what? You can raise the level of expectation from making architecture, from making it, some people, you know, when you talk a lot about matter of scale and being a generalist. The pitfall of being a generalist, the most common pitfall, is that buildings are just buildings, they're commodities. They are treated as a commodity. We've done 10 of these, let's do 10 more and move on. It's very profitable, it's wonderful. We're generalists. To be willing to take on every project as a brand new opportunity and to think of it anew is something that takes more work, takes more effort, it takes a willingness to learn something new, it takes a willingness to teach your client to expect more, to raise that bar. That effort that you put into it, though, will pay off in spades, because you will have learned something and you will have taught something and you will have made something better.
Taran Duda and Jeff Payne, thank you very much, both of you, for being so open and honest and transparent about the growth of your firm and how you've done what you do and how others can learn from what you do. I appreciate you both for spending some time here with me. The website is Duda Payne, DudaPaine.com. The firm is Duda Payne Architects. You can learn more about them at their website. Taran and Jeff, this was a fantastic conversation. I appreciate you very much for being here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you.
Really appreciate talking with you today. Thank you.
Okay, so you've been listening to episode 317. That's 317. The link to the show notes and the link to share with a friend. Please share this episode with a friend. Is entrearchitect.com/episode317, entrearchitect.com/episode317. Again, you'll notice that most of the interviews during the next couple of weeks have no reference to COVID-19 or the CARES Act or anything else that we're going through right now. I want you to continue to learn from these episodes, learn from what our guests are talking about, apply them as necessary and as practical. I hope you are well. I know that there's so much going on right now. We've been receiving so much information about COVID-19 and the recent stimulus package, the CARES Act approved by our federal government. It's overwhelming, I know. And I hope that you keep coming back here to find a place of comfort, a place where you know that you'll find a...
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And Brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay. We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.